Hey, welcome to the Security Channel podcast. I'm Curtis Franklin, Senior Technology Editor at Network Computing, and your host for these podcasts. This installation, we have the latest and what is probably the last for a while in what has become our series on identity theft. This time, I had a chance to sit down over the phone and talk with Mike Gibbons, who is VP and General Manager of Federal Security Solutions at Unisys. Now, Mike brings some interesting perspective to all this. Mike was with the FBI for 15 years, following which he served as the practice leader for security at one of the Big Five consultancies. So he has spent his professional life dealing with folks who are up to no good, and also with protecting very large organizations, whether they're governmental or private or public organizations. I enjoyed having a chance to talk with him about his take on some of the big issues facing corporations as they deal with identity theft and customer data protection and all of the other issues that seem to be positioning themselves at the center of what we're doing for security right now. Anyway, enjoy the conversation that I had with Mike. I think you'll find it interesting, and I will be back at the end to give you some ideas about what's coming up in future Security Channel podcasts. Mike Gibbons. Mike, as we look at the computer security and fraud cases that have been in the news so much over the past, let's say, 12 months, one of the things that strikes me is how little law enforcement is mentioned in the news accounts. It seems like all of the emphasis is on the affected company and its customers. Do you think that this is something that is cultural in the computer industry, and or is it just something we're not seeing in the news?
Well, that's a great question. What's interesting to me is not this, you haven't heard law enforcement talked about a lot. You haven't heard a lot of questions to the companies about what they're doing to engage with law enforcement. But I think the answer is something on the order of law enforcement doesn't have anything to gain by talking to the media. In fact, quite the contrary is true. Anything that law enforcement says to the media could later show up at a trial or in the hands of an attorney, and then they can be grilled on it. So law enforcement shouldn't be there to judge or make comments about what's going on. They're supposed to be there to collect the evidence, preserve the evidence, limit the damage if possible, kind of contain what's going on, help business to continue to operate, and they shouldn't be focused on what the media perception is. That's up to the company to manage.
Okay. Well, you know, you mentioned perception. I had an interesting conversation with the fellow who was the chief information security officer at ChoicePoint, which found itself in the news in a big way a few months ago. One of his points in our conversation was that what happened to them was barely a computer issue at all. It was really classic fraud that just happened to involve a computer media. Do you think that there's some sort of perception that if a computer is involved at all, that it's somehow a different class of activity?
You know, we found it when the time I worked at the FBI, during the time I worked at the FBI, the 15 years I spent there, that there were two types of computer crimes in general. One was the type where a computer was the target of the crime, meaning that they were trying to break into a computer or exceed their access authority to get information, something valuable, so the information was what they really were after. And then the second type of the crime was where computers are a tool of the crime, meaning you used a computer, maybe to do an online spam scam or build a Trojan horse that goes out and gives you access to someone's private account information or a keystroke, implant a keystroke logger to get their banking information or log on. So computers can be a tool. Computers can be a tool for online gambling and bookies to keep track of the bets. They can be white-collar tools where they print phony certificate deposits and sell them to unsuspecting customers. So computers are a tool of many kinds of just regular larceny. And so, once again, a lot of what we've seen in the press in the last few months, actually they fit into both camps. Some of them were, break-ins into computer systems to steal personal information. Other ones where, computers were just a tool to further a crime, what might be just, a typical scam if a computer wasn't involved.
Right. Yeah, I heard someone mentioning that things like the Nigerian oil account scam existed before there were computers. It happened in paper mail. It just happens a lot faster and to, I suppose, more people due to email.
Yes, absolutely. We worked those cases back in the mid-1980s. I actually worked those frauds.
Ah, lucky you.
We actually caught a few of them, too. That was the great part.
Oh, that's something. And, that's something that sort of plays into this perception game. I saw a report from the conference board, the folks who usually are surveying consumers on consumer confidence and things like that. They did a survey of consumers on their online transaction and commerce beliefs and preferences. And one of the things they found was that customers have started to say, yes, we're concerned about this, and yes, it's affecting our likelihood to conduct business on the internet. Is there a perception game that companies are losing with their customers right now?
I would like to say that in the United States, the customers, I think, are more aware of the problems and the potential for fraud than, say, in Great Britain. Unisys, the company I work for, did a survey just recently, we just announced, for consumer perception on identity theft and fraud and, kind of what are the safety issues, whether or not they were concerned about identity theft online. And what we found was that they were much less worried about online identity theft and fraud in Great Britain than what we found in the United States. And what we determined was because they were not as concerned, we kind of made a quantum leap that we think that they may be less informed and that could actually lead to more fraud. Because if people are concerned and they do pay attention and maybe take some kind of mitigating steps to limit their risk, say if I want to go ahead and buy things online, maybe I use a credit card that has a lower credit limit and I really watch that credit card because I use it for online. So the potential for abuse would be lower, meaning a lower dollar amount, and I just pay attention to it. You are less likely to be made a victim if you pay more attention, to just the basics. So I think in the U.S., the U.S. consumers become much more aware because of things, problems we've seen in the last few months. And I think that's why we've seen such a hue and outcry and, in potential legislation coming out of Congress to try to, support consumers.
Okay. Well, we'll get back to that legislation question in a few minutes. But quickly, when you look at the response of U.S. consumers, would you say that consumers are worried to the proper extent? Are we still a little too laissez-faire about this, or have people begun to swing into the unnecessarily paranoid camp?
Well, I think the pendulum always has an opportunity to swing both ways. At any given point, a person who has had an identity theft problem probably thinks it's a really big deal because it happened to them. It's kind of like surgery. Surgery on me is major surgery. Surgery on you is minor surgery. But the consumers who have had, and again, when we did a survey here in the U.S., we found that 1 in 10 households had someone affected by identity theft in the past year. So, there have been quite a few consumers who have had bad things happen. And as a lot of this It really takes a long time to clean up with the credit bureaus and the companies, and even sometimes you have to go to court yourself to get things straightened out. So it's really annoying, not to mention you could actually lose money. So I would like to think that everyone should be aware of this. Given a categorical, they're not paranoid enough or too paranoid, I would fall under the notion that I think it's not a Chicken Little affair. You know, it's not the sky is falling. I think the sky is already fallen, and it's just a matter of when a piece hits you in the head.
Okay. Well, given that we are surrounded by cascades of sky, what should companies be doing to reassure their customers that doing business with them via the internet is a safe thing to do?
Well, you know, the challenge with businesses is they have to make a business case for why they need to do that very thing. And I'd like to think that a lot of businesses can differentiate themselves by actually maybe taking some of the steps of what we've seen Congress recommending, and that's actually assign a privacy or chief security officer or maybe one in the same role and actually decide how they're protecting their data, whether they're doing it properly, and then brag to their consumers and trading partners that they're doing a good job with it. So, crime prevention in many cases is about creating the perception that you care about it. It's the old broken window theory. You know, if a factory is kind of deserted and you break a window out, within a week all the windows are going to be broken out. But if you replace the window, then, you know, they're not as likely to break the other ones. It's like, you know, the perception and kind of the mood is everything. And I think the climate here in the U.S. has been shifting to where privacy has become more and more of a big deal, kind of what we saw in Europe a couple years ago. So I think that businesses should figure out how to differentiate themselves by paying attention to this, affixing responsibility in their company, and then bragging about it or, you know, telling people what a good job they're doing.
Okay. I was struck by the fact that the first thing you talked about was having a responsible officer in charge. When I talk to companies, so often I hear them talking about deploying new technology. We love to deploy technology as part of the solution to a problem.
Yeah. You know what's funny is, and I'm really glad you brought that up, there's three core tenets to security, and all the security architectures that we work with involve technology, but people and processes as well. So let's say that it's a technology issue to have a password control system, right? You have to enter a strong password to get on a computer, and a lot of companies to sign on. But it's a process issue that if an employee is fired or walked out of the building, that there should have a process whereby that person's user IDs and identity is taken out of the computer systems, their role taken out, and their access revoked so that they can't continue to get into the computer system. That's a process issue. Many years ago, down in Tampa, Florida, there was a person who worked at a television station who was fired, and he went to work for a competitor. And even though he was fired, he did not have his user account and dial-up account taken away by his old employer. So for weeks, he kept logging on to the old employer's computer system, finding out what stories they were working on, and then he would scoop them and come out a day before they broadcast with a scooped version, and they figured out something was wrong. And his only mistake, why he got caught and ultimately got prosecuted for it, was because the police came and interviewed him, asked him if he was doing it, and he denied it, and then continued doing it. So he was also a dumb criminal, but that's what happens.
It's wonderful when you can count on dumb criminals, isn't it?
It's hilarious.
Well, one of the questions that a lot of people think is answered already is the question of whether there are going to be more federal laws and regulations involving private information, the storage of that information, transmission of information. Do you think that it's only a brief matter of time before we have some fairly wide-reaching privacy and security legislation regarding the way data's personal information is stored?
Yeah, well, the good news is I don't have to have a crystal ball, a copy of Google, to read copies of this legislation that's right now pending in many different places. You know, we've taken a look at some of this core legislation, and some of the things that this legislation is doing, in my humble opinion, would go a long way to help set a tone for business of what is and is not acceptable behavior. And one of the things they're strongly pushing is the fact that there has to be notification if a security breach occurs. I personally have worked with some large institutions. I know one large financial 200 company that already has a committee building their database internally for how they'll keep track of notification of any security events, just, you know, with one of the ideas to be compliant with this legislation and to start keeping track of everything centrally so that they'll know their compliance officer will be able to ensure that they notify the appropriate customers in case of a security breach. So, once again, I don't have to have a crystal ball to say that Congress is serious about this. I feel that business has had a very long time to pay attention to this, and even though you know, business has had a long time to pay attention to this, they haven't necessarily done so. So here comes Congress, and I think that they're, you know, proposing some very significant legislation.
You know, a long time ago, I worked for a company that had, as part of what it did, an airline. And one of the drills we went through a couple times a year was the what do we do if a plane goes down drill, which was all about everything from notifying family members to dealing with the FAA to dealing with the press. Do you think that's the kind of drill that any company that stores large numbers of individual information accounts should be preparing to go through?
Well, that's an excellent question too. So the premise is if a company has a lot of, you know, significant data, and in some cases that involves privacy of its customers, sometimes the sensitive data is in their formulas or patents or things, you know, proprietary intellectual property. I'd say sensitive data, not just or merely personal data, then that company should have an incident response plan. They should have exercised it. They should know how they're going to manage an incident. Actually, they should start with constituting a definition of what an incident is, you know, what a security breach is, and that should drive some other behavior, like do we involve the general counsel? Do we involve our marketing? You know, is the CEO notified? I mean, who are the people that manage this event? And there's a whole side of forensic services. Do we have the right people either on retainer or on staff who can contain the incident, understand what happened, and make sure it doesn't happen again? And, the legislation is pushing that they'll have to also involve and talk to law enforcement. Like you said earlier in this discussion, law enforcement often comes in as part of the, you know, forensic response in significant cases. So, law enforcement will defer to your experts as long as they have the right qualifications and are certified in the correct ways. In many cases, I've seen, you know, security engineers with the right clearances and whatnot go in and even do work for government right alongside or ahead of a federal investigator who are, you know, unfortunately spread kind of thin right now.
Okay. Well, let me ask, if someone came to you and was asking what their company should be putting in place to deal with the reality on the ground as it is and be well positioned for the legislation is to come, if you could offer them four suggestions to get ready, what are the top four things that people should be planning to do right now in order to get ready for all this?
Well, you know, I haven't thought a lot about that, but I do think the first step is to identify and categorize what kind of information you store and process and where it's stored and processed, everywhere from collection, you know, management, processed, and also how you dispose of your data. Just basically understand, you know, kind of what information you work with. That's kind of the first step, taking an inventory. Second is probably assigning someone to make sure that their role or responsibility is to be the chief security or privacy officer. We saw Gartner has reported that about 75% of the Fortune 1000 companies would have, you know, chief information security officers reporting at a high level over the next year. That leaves to believe that 25% of them won't. So someone responsible for this, you know, thinking about this is probably critical. I think that they have to make sure, each company has to make sure they have minimum standards for security. They have to figure out just how much security is enough for themselves. And each company is going to be different. You're going to protect different types of information in different ways. A business can't spend all of their capital protecting the information. They have to have a pragmatic approach. But they need to set the bar somewhere and over time understand that. So the minimum standards could take the form of policies, or it could take the form actually of, you know, kind of some procedures and things like that. But the other thing, one of the other things that's important is when you have your policies and you have your program kind of in place for information security, you have to communicate that to employees. So I think a program of communication is also something that is much overlooked. For U.S. government agencies, it's been a federal law since 1987 that every government employee every year has to get information security training. That would be a good step for corporations to take, a step in the right direction.
Outstanding. Now, I have to ask, we've been talking all about the companies, but do consumers hold some responsibility in all of this as well?
Well, you know, a lot of the problems that we've seen over the last, say, year and a half have come from individual users with broadband internet connections whose computers have been taken over and they're being exploited by outside bad forces, you know, people using the dark side of the force. So the challenge I've got is whenever someone says, what can a consumer do, there's two basic things. They have to have up-to-date current antivirus software on their computer, and they have to have a personal level firewall running if their, you know, internet connection or their router doesn't have it. And then going beyond that, the real challenge is all around the attachments to email being a significant threat and the new spyware, you know, potential malware that can come from even just plain web browsing these days when you browse questionable sites. I don't think you're gonna have a problem going to, a regular reputable media outlet, but, you know, there's an awful lot of questionable internet sites out there, and some of them have hostile code nowadays. So I would say that individuals who are not following this, who have their computers taken over, have been really contributing to these problems. And the other thing is, turn on, if you're running a Windows XP, turn on automatic patch download management. It's been a big benefit to people, so they haven't had to pay that much attention to it. Automatic virus updates, so you don't have to do it, it just happens. And those are some, and like to get training about now how not to open an email message attachment. One thing I'd share with you though is, the concern I've had is, those are the generic, kind of protections. If someone wants to really truly get you with a focused attack and use a combination of methods to get to your information, you better have a lot of training and really be on your guard all the time. That's all I can say. So if I called you up as a journalist and said, hey, I called you up and say, hey, I got this really hot story for you. My name is Bill. I work in this big Fortune 100 company, and God, this is a hot IT story. You got to run it. Just look for an email message from Bill and open up the spreadsheet I'm going to send you. You might be more likely, would you not, to open that email message?
The likelihood goes up when you've had additional contacts, no question.
So that's applying social engineering to a Trojan horse attachment, and now I've increased my likelihood of success that you launch an attachment. It may look like something, it may not, or maybe it crashes, but it doesn't give you an indication that just planted a back door, in your computer, and now I can read all the stories and everything you're working on and on and on. And so my challenge is for these blanket spam Trojan horse things where they're casting a wide net, then these protections are going to be safeguarded. But for someone who's a real adversary, someone who really wants to get into a company or get into a person's personal data, boy, it's just a challenge, and there's so many protections they have to have in place. They really have to have, a lot of training and a lot of understanding in this.
Well, you know, that's an awfully heavy burden for something that the industry has tried to convince us for the past 20 years is just a fun and convenient tool to use. I work and live in a college town. We got kids coming back on campus over the next couple of weeks. And over the course of the next month, there are going to be lots and lots of ads and programs and seminars
for the new students on how to protect themselves. You know, don't walk alone in dark places, you know, be on your guard, all of the standard things for physical safety. Is it time to start a public service campaign on safe computing? What's the answer? How do we train people?
Yeah, I think you've got something there. Practice safe computing. How's that? You know, in your personal life and, you know, habits out in the nightclubs are one thing, but, you know, safe computing, you know, is just taking, you know, having some basic steps. And, you know, boy, it was interesting to me a few years ago when I saw Dr. Gene Spafford at Purdue introduce a class on ethics in computing. It was one of the first ones I saw. And I thought it was interesting that he said that some of the students, you know, in conversations I had with him, I don't think he announced this publicly, he said some of the students actually said, well, if I can break into a computer back, you know, this is 5 or 6 years or 10 years ago even now, if I can break into a computer, you know, what's to stop me? Why shouldn't I do that? And it wasn't, it was more of a technical discussion than an ethical discussion. And I've heard that same thing with spam. If I can do it, why wouldn't I spin out spam messages to make some extra bucks or whatever? So, you know, some of these things that people may not view as quote unquote wrong.
Right.
So, when you take that, to take your kind of, this, you know, kind of scenario a little bit further, if you have someone in a college and they're teaching them how not to walk out, you know, go out in pairs, don't go to the library at 11 o'clock at night by yourself in dark alleys. Same thing with computing. Don't go to websites that are questionable. Try to make sure, like I said, some of the technical safeguards are in place, and make sure that your computer is always, you know, kept up to date with its patches and software. But again, I think you made the best point. This is no longer a simple discussion and an easy thing. It's become a requirement that is getting to be more and more of a real burden. And I'd like to think that the builders of future operating systems are going to figure out how to stop things from buffer overflows or attacks on the kernel to be able to occur. So I think that what we really need is the next generation internet, next generation of operating systems to make it so that this doesn't happen anymore. And one of the kind of steps in that direction is another thing I've seen a lot lately is companies who route all of their email through a third-party kind of cleansing service, and that cleans out all the spam, cleans out all the hostile code and viruses, and even guarantees you won't get viruses before it comes back in. So all their internet email going in and out of their company is run through a bunch of cleansing filters so that they don't have to deal and clog their servers up inside their corporation or campus with a bunch of junk mail and spam. That was interesting. So I think that's another trend. And so it becomes a ubiquitous kind of simple service. They just automatically or automagically, they don't have the big problem a lot of other people have. Of course, they're paying for that service, but, you know, it's a necessary service when 70% of the spam, according to sources, is, 70% of email and internet is spam. That's a significant number.
Sure. Well, first, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me this afternoon. I've got one final question, and that's, as you look out on all the things you see, are you optimistic that everything's going to work together to make us more secure and relieve some of these issues? Or do you think we still have an awful lot of tunnel to go through before we get to the light at the end?
Well, you know, being the all-seeing oracle and being in this business since 1985, I worked the first two big computer crime cases with the Cuckoo's Egg case, and I also prosecuted Robert Morris for the Internet Worm case, the original time the Internet went down for 3 days. Let me just say this. We've come a long way in time, but we haven't come that far. We still see a lot of the same things happening now that happened 20 years ago, and for those who don't know history repeats itself. What I'd like to think is if we can create, again, the perception that somebody cares, and through some technical means, create a way to attribute some actions to individuals that would cause a difference in actions. Meaning that, you know, if I thought when I was a teenager that I'd get caught at something, I was less likely to, you know, keep the car out past midnight. If I could sneak in my bedroom window, you know, that's one thing. And on the internet, there's been an awful lot of anonymity. And granted, there's been anonymity of good purpose for social activities and, you know, people changing the course of governments. I understand why they'd want to be anonymous. But anonymity in e-commerce and business, I don't think has the same place. I think that we may need an internet where people are held accountable for what they say and do, And so we see, I see kind of like maybe through the internet, IPv6 or something, and other things. I see through stronger identification and access controls and stronger source identification on the very packets arriving at your computer, maybe people's activities would change if it was trivial for someone to come track you down and have a discussion about sending me spam. If I could get the name and home phone number of every person sending me spam, I guarantee you I'd go visit some of them myself.
We will look forward to that time. I can see all sorts of interesting road trips.
How soon that's going to occur, I don't know. But, boy, I hope for that day, in my lifetime anyway.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, that was Mike Gibbons of Unisys, and I thought there were some mighty interesting points there, especially about companies becoming more proactive in dealing with threats. Some of the early things in the interview about working with law enforcement, and finally the idea that as the internet and the technologies that enable the internet develop, we might actually end up with some more tools for protecting our systems and making our internet lives a little bit more pleasant. Well, as I said at the beginning, this is going to be the last identity theft podcast for a little while. We're going to look at some other issues. I've got a number of things that I'm lining up, including some technologies on protecting infrastructure, some issues on personnel, which actually get too little mention in most of our security things, and also going to be looking at some training issues, how to train people in becoming security experts. In addition, we've got some shorter things coming up, as well as some additional guests. I've got an idea for a podcast that we're tentatively calling Stupid Hacker Tricks. Get some folks who spend their lives looking at attack signatures, talking about some of the silly things that come their way. As always, please let me know what you think about the podcast. Feel free to drop me an email, cfranklin@nwc.com, and let me know what kind of podcast you would like to hear. We do these for you, not just for us. So let us know what kind of things you want to hear, and we'll do our best to put them in your MP3 player. Well, until next time, for the Security Channel and Network Computing, this is Curtis Franklin. So long.